Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Philip Lance, and I'm your host today, interviewing Dr. Cordelia Schmidt-Hillerau about her novel, Memory's Eyes, published by IP Books in 2020. By way of introducing the book, I'll just say that the front cover calls it, quote, a New York Oedipus novel, unquote, which I understand to mean that it takes place mostly in New York City, and it's structured by the myth of Oedipus. Cordelia Schmidt-Hillerau, PhD, is a training and supervising analyst of the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute and the Swiss Psychoanalytic Society. She has published numerous papers and three books on metapsychology, clinical issues, and applied psychoanalysis. Her 2018 publication of Driven to Survive was a finalist of the American Board and Academy of Psychoanalysis Book Prize. Her first novel, I think I'm pronouncing this right, Rousseau's Traum, I think is a German title, was published in 2019. Since 2017, she is the chair of the IPA and Culture Committee. She works in private practice in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. And so welcome to the program, Cordelia.
Thank you, Philip, and thank you for having me for this interview and for taking an interest in my novel, Memory's Eyes.
You're welcome. And I'm. This has got me into the first novel I'm actually, usually I'm reviewing or interviewing people about, you know, theoretical or clinical books. But I think this one's going to give our listeners who love psychoanalysis a really interesting taste of some theoretical and clinical issues, but in a novel form. So it's a treat for me. And why don't you just tell us what's the story of the birth of this book?
Well, I am a psychoanalyst by profession. I always love to read and write. But when I came to the United States in 2000 and started here to work clinically and in my institute, the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, I was confronted with the idea that the Oedipus is outdated. It's an old concept that is of not much use anymore. And this idea of the waning Oedipus struck me as rather strange, because I think the Oedipus is something that we experience throughout our lives, and of course in particular when we grow up. And it is a great concept, a very complex and essential concept. And so I thought of telling a bit or creating situations of everyday life that are full of Oedipal situations, configurations of triangulation and envy and rivalry, and but also longings, confusion, all these things that come up with the Oedipus complex in the child's mind and linger throughout life. And that's what I wanted to show in a contemporary story.
I think,
yeah?
Yeah, going to be very useful for a lot of psychodynamic clinicians who might be listening, people interested in psychoanalysis who know that Oedipal theory was central, huge, core to sort of classical psychoanalysis, but maybe they don't get exposed to it much anymore. For instance, in my training, which was in a sort of British Object Relations Institute, we didn't talk about the Oedipal myth or the Oedipal complex much at all. There was some talk about pre-Oedipal a little bit, but really not even that. So I think as I was reading through your novel, I got so caught up in the story, I wasn't paying too much attention to where the Oedipal myth was showing up. But every now and then I'd go, it would sort of dawn on me, oh, we're talking about Oedipal things here.
Yeah, you know, you are right. It is an experience in the development of psychoanalysis that in a certain time, one particular idea or concept is central. And for a long time with Freud and after, the Oedipus complex was the center of psychoanalysis. And then the interest shifted to narcissism, for instance, and to borderline personality disorders, and then to self and self-psychology, or now to Bion. And in the wake of these developments, which are good and necessary and enhance our understanding of the human mind, often it happens that previously developed concepts are thought of not useful anymore, that they are replaced with a new one rather than added on, so that even a person with self-psychological issues or narcissistic problems does have at some point to struggle with Oedipal issues, and actually in particular when the analysis progresses from pre-Oedipal to Oedipal issues, then we see a much more lively mind that has all these strong feelings, and it's actually fun to work with these. That's at least my experience.
Yeah, I've had that experience, I think, with some of my clients too, the ones who are far enough along to get there. So when I read this novel, I didn't know anything about you except that you are the author of this book. And the protagonist, I guess we call it, of the book is a woman named Anne. And so I kept imagining as I was reading the book, oh, this is the author. This is she's telling about the story of her life in a way. So now whenever I think of you, I think of this character in the novel, Anne. But how much of this book is autobiographical, and if there's any selected passages you want to read at this point, I think this might be a good time to do that too.
Yeah, your question is totally understandable, and of course, I think every novel, whatever it tackles, has the author in it in some ways or other. Now, there are more autobiographical novels than this one is. This one is actually very closely related to the three Sophocles plays, Oedipus Rex, Oedipus at Colonus, and Antigone. And I have devoted chapter or maybe a part in this novel to each of these dramas, because they show the whole life of Oedipus from the beginning basically till after its end. And normally we hear the Oedipus complex discussed with the male figure Oedipus, but I wanted to tell the story from the perspective of Antigone. So the main figure in this novel is Anne, basically a contemporary Antigone, who talks about how she imagines her father came to New York, how her parents lived in New York before she was even born. And then in the second part, which equals Oedipus at Colonus, there is this part, as you know, is about Oedipus and Antigone traveling for 20 years before they find Oedipus' resting place. This is the part in my novel that they travel through Tuscany. And in the third part, this is totally devoted to Antigone. So in the place. So in that sense, it is the whole novel is told from the point of view of Anne, and I can just perhaps read how the whole novel starts and how she introduces her ideas about her father, if that's okay.
Yes, please do.
So Antigone says, "So this is my story. My father, Edward or Stark, or just Eddie, as everybody calls him, comes to New York one ordinary afternoon with a small bag in one hand and a street and subway map in the other, comes in by train from Philadelphia, where he had lived with his aunt Margaret in her fine apartment for as long as he could remember, and gets out, finally, at Grand Central Station. Now, here he is in the middle of a totally amazing moment, new and free. He looks around. What an energetic crowd of people, he thinks, racing and zipping back and forth between trains and stairways, and all the blinking and sparkling showcases in this huge hall of Grand Central Station. Grand Central Station. And everybody's calling and chatting and yelling and laughing, and all so useful and earnest and determined, like Eddie himself hasn't felt in a long while, if ever. This is it, he thinks. Instantaneously, he knows, this is my city. This is where I want to be. He has a bit of money in his bank account, his inheritance from Aunt Margaret. Not much, but enough to comfortably risk a new start and move into a bed and breakfast or a cheap hotel for as long as it will take to find a more decent place to stay, a place where he has his own bed and fridge and can do his own laundry. My father said he loved New York at first sight, and strangely enough, he had this distinct feeling that he belonged here. He wasn't naive. As protected as his small world had been up to this point, he always was a smart observer and somehow knew about the difficulties in settling in a new place. His habit was to scan things carefully and only then decide. So I see him leaning against a big post next to a coffee shop, looking around. What now, he wonders. The total freedom of choice intimidates him in its enormity. Every step he will take from here can easily lead his life in a different direction, and there's no way to foresee the consequences or to make a reasonable decision. On the other hand, this is the adventure of life. Eddie has finally arrived in New York.
Okay, so I'm really interested by thinking about our fathers' lives before we were there. It's kind of what this Anne is imagining. And this one thing I wondered, the Grand Central Station, is that like the world of daily activity and busyness? Is that, what was the name of the city? Was it Thebes, where Oedipus ends up and meets Jocasta, his mother?
Yes, one could say so. I mean, I have not too closely related those, but I thought more the Grand Central Station can kind of symbolize the momentous stages in our lives where we do make a decision. And in fact, as you say, Eddie will make a fateful decision and meet the figures of all the complicated members of the Oedipus family of Sophocles' plays.
And, you know, I asked about the autobiographical nature of this this novel, and you answered that very well. Although I still find myself wondering, did Cordelia have a father who came to New York City? You don't have to answer this, but just kind of makes, I don't know why I'm so curious about, you know, how much of this really happened?
Well, actually, it's funny. My father never was in New York. He never got to travel to New York. I grew up in Germany, and he traveled many parts of the world, but somehow never made it to New York. But New York, you know, I thought is basically the quintessential city of modern American life. It's the locations that I use in this novel, like Central Park or Fifth Avenue and others, they are really in New York. And I know New York a little bit, and I love this city. It's a great city, very exciting, and has a lot to offer. So I love to place the novel in New York. But I also think New York is a bit of a paradigm of modern life. Actually, my first novel that was published only in German so far, Rousseau's Dream, also plays in New York. And not because the people necessarily have to live there, but because I think it is so such a central idea of modern life and modern American life that I think it is suitable for a place for a modern novel.
Uh-huh. And I know a lot of our listeners are New Yorkers. It's kind of the center of psychoanalysis in some ways too.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, not internationally even. And I'm so glad I lived in New York in the late 80s in Chelsea for 2 years. And I'm so glad I lived there because there's no place like it. Well, that's, you know, this novel, my experience reading through it is that it started speeding up. And the last, I don't know, third of it really became sort of this exciting roller coaster ride. But can you speak about the pace, and was there some, is there a method behind the madness of the ending?
Well, this is really an interesting observation. I wasn't aware of this, but it makes total sense to me when you say this, because the first part covers many years. I would say about at least 20, maybe even in the end, certainly more than 20 years. The second part covers 5 months, and the third part covers 5 hours. So, in fact, one can see that there is a time component which I wasn't really aware of or thinking about, but that may speak to what you noticed, the acceleration of pace. All three parts are more or less of the same length, and so we can see that the more detailed I look time-wise, the faster it seems to draw to the end.
Yeah, and quite exciting as things build in this story. At the ending of the story, felt really right to me, and somehow I don't want to spoil it, but maybe so I'll let you sort of. Do you want to say anything about the ending and how we can think about that?
I don't want to spoil the ending either, but in more general terms, I can say what happens when in psychoanalysis we work through the Oedipal issues. Many of our patients think when they come to analysis, okay, I have some problems, and at the end of the analysis, I have worked them through and they will be gone. But this is not the case. What we help our patients to do is to think about them, to become aware of these problems, of these issues, to recognize them when they show up again in particular situations. And so the Oedipus complex finds, in some ways, as Freud says, a resolution when the child grows out of it at the age of 6 or so. And the resolution at best is the idea of the child to say, okay, now I'm still a child, but when I'm grown up, I can also have a partner like my mommy or like my daddy has. I can also get married or have children and can do the grown-up things. Until then, I have to grow and learn. And so in that sense, I think the novel tries to show a certain development that the protagonist, Anne, makes. Also her father, Eddie, to some extent. And so this development makes them aware of what they hadn't known so far. So there is something, an enriched understanding of their lives that comes to both main figures in this novel. I think this awareness does help them to live a better and freer life, not to enact old secret stories, but to reflect upon them and start to live their own lives. Certainly that is true, I think, or hope for Anne.
This novel deals with the myth of Oedipus and also with, of course, psychoanalysis. And I think as the novel goes on, certain actual psychoanalysts, people who are psychoanalysts, become more, even more central to the story, and then references the characters who are in analysis. And at sometimes in the near the beginning or middle-ish, I thought, oh, there's kind of some idealization of psychoanalysis going on here. Those illusions are sort of disrupted near the end, where there's a very sort of not so ideal picture of what sometimes happens in the world of psychoanalysis. So do you want to say anything about that issue?
Yeah. I have actually two answers to your question about the idealization. The one is the style. I sometimes have used a kind of gushing style, being all wrapped up in how wonderful a person is or so. And this runs a bit counter to the current contemporary spare or minimalistic style. I did this because I think this is how our fantasies work. When we fantasize about something, we idealize the situation that we wish for. And in reality, of course, we know it's not so ideal as we would like to enjoy. But I can say also that I do love psychoanalysis. I think it is an endlessly fascinating undertaking, and it is empowering. And so what I always liked with psychoanalysis was it follows the lines of Kant's enlightenment when he calls on us to have the courage to own our own mind, to think independently, to reflect, and to discover in our own world reasons that we hadn't thought about before. In that sense, I wouldn't call it idealization, but I would say in that sense, I certainly am a fan of psychoanalysis. I would love to be able to recommend it to everybody who has the capacity to do analytic work. Now, that being said, I'm also aware of that psychoanalysis sometimes unleashes quite some powerful emotions and in particular transferences. And so to handle these transferences and emotions is not that easy. And that's why sometimes, unfortunately, our profession stumbles. And in that sense, it is what you call the darker side in psychoanalysis. For instance, in a small way, already the non-relution of transference at the end of an analysis, so that the patient stays in a lifelong idealizing dependency on his or her former analyst. That is a little bit a problem, I think, to when the analyst doesn't want to let the patient go and live his own life, even if he hasn't reached what the analyst has thought for him would be possible or desirable. So it's not that easy. Since idealizations tend to look only at the bright side, I thought it is important also to have a look at the not so bright side in our field, or the dangers that run with the glory.
I want to get back to the dark side in just a moment, because that's a really interesting part of the book. But as an aside, I'm so glad you mentioned that what you called the gushing style, which is there here and there. It's not throughout. But because when I was first reading, there were some moments early on when I don't know, there were like exclamation marks, and I started sensing that little bit of gushing style. And I thought, I don't know if I like this. This is not the kind of literature I'm used to reading. But nevertheless, so I had that kind of negative judgment in my mind. But nevertheless, I couldn't put it down. I kept reading. And so now you helped me understand.
Yeah. Can I give us a sample of it so that it becomes perhaps a bit more clear to the listener what I mean with a gushing style? Would that be okay?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So this is also from the beginning. Eddie comes to New York. He finds a room in a kind of romantically run-down Soho Inn. And now I describe the next day. In the morning, when he gets down to the small breakfast area, there's a woman sitting and reading the art section of the New York Times, her dark curly hair still entangled and befuddled from a short and agitated sleep, I imagine, loosely falls over the slim bones of her shoulders, completely covering her face. Who is she? Eddie wonders. The woman is so involved in the paper that she doesn't even look at Eddie when he sits down at her table. There's only one table in the small dining area, and all hotel guests are supposed to eat there between 7 and 9 a.m. So he looks around, feels slightly allergic to the red and pink roses on the wallpaper, the frayed plush on the chairs, the lace cloth on the credenza, all this an offense to his sense of taste. My father has a very fine sense of aesthetics. And so he starts doubting that he will stay here for another night, when all of a sudden he notices the woman's sleeve. The sleeve is hanging down from her hand holding the newspaper, which she is slowly lowering, either because her hand is following her eyes as they near the end of the article at the bottom of the column, or because she is so disappointed with what she is reading that all her day's energy is momentarily seeping out of her. Anyway, the sleeve of her brocade-embroidered dressing gown is dipping like a thirsty tongue into her cup of black coffee, greedily sucking it up and licking it off and drowning in brown the features of an idyllic Chinese country life that had just been pleasantly playing and dancing along her soft silken forearm. Madame, your sleeve, Eddie cautiously says, and it might have sounded like your slave, because the woman moves her newspaper to the side and looks at him with utter surprise. How beautiful she is. Even though maybe in her 40s, she radiates a youthful, even girlish freshness, but also a loving maturity, a thoughtful depth, a sweet manner, and such a harmonious soul, that Eddie falls head over heels for her, loses himself in her eyes, these gorgeous eyes. When has he last or ever seen eyes like hers, so open to him, so clear and calmly focused, so interested and intelligent? She looks as if she has gone through all kinds of human issues, from energizing to destructive, and enjoyed and survived it all. Eddie is speechless. As soon as he has recovered his wits, he reiterates, "Your sleeve, sleeve, I mean," and points at what he's talking about. "Oh," says the woman, now realizing her maladroitness, and a shadow of regret glides over her eyes like a rain cloud, which gets Eddie fired up. "I actually know how to completely eliminate coffin stains," he has the presence of mind to come up with. "I'm something of a magician with regard to coffee stains." The woman smiles, possibly comforted, perhaps amused, and certainly curious. "Are you?" she responds. "Yes," Eddie confirms, and has no idea where this will get him, but he's so pleased to see his breakfast partner smile again. "I'm Eddie," he introduces himself, advancing his hand towards hers while lifting himself up a bit to produce an elegant bow. "Hi, Eddie, I'm Joyce," Joyce responds and hands him her hand, which he delicately takes, barely touching it, only to breathe on it, or rather indicate, an old-fashioned hand kiss. "Nice to meet you," he gallantly says and sits down. This is what our heroes get to live out in our fantasies. And my father was my hero. For many years he was. And maybe he still is. So this is one of those gushing paragraphs with which I wanted to indicate how we would love things to be so romantic and so wonderful, so complete and all comprehensive in one single moment that we live through. And I know that it may sound kitschy. It is actually supposed to be a little kitschy, because that's what our fantasy lives are when we think of it, or think of it without telling anybody else, because we would be ashamed to do so.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess you're helping me understand how this passage worked for me. Just my impression.
How did you react?
Well, one little, the line that says, "Who is she?" Eddie wonders as he's seeing this woman. And then something about her eyes, those gorgeous eyes, when has he last or ever seen eyes like hers? And so suddenly I started thinking of, and throughout the novel, there's places where a mother and a son look into each other's eyes. And it made me just associate to my mother's eyes, which are blue, and mine are blue. Mm-hmm. And in our family of six, me and my mother are the two who have blue eyes. And
wonderful.
Yeah, there's so that sort of stirring up sort of feelings in me.
Yeah, there is something special that will always be special for us, even if we mature and live a normal life and don't have these or wouldn't admit to these strong feelings, but they can be revived in psychoanalysis. And if we are honest to ourselves, we still may have them at times.
Well, let's move on from the gushing style to the dark side. The theme of incest comes up here. Now, and you might want to say something about that, because our listeners who might be familiar with the Oedipus myth might miss what incest has to do with that, and with psychoanalysis and the transference. And this novel gets into questions of boundary violations in institutes. So somehow you wove all that together really beautifully in this novel, and that's kind of a generalized way of talking about it, but maybe you can respond to that.
Yeah. You know, when I came to Boston I came only to Boston in 2000, and in the first 10 years that I lived here and worked as an analyst, three major cases of alleged sexual boundary violations occurred, and that was deeply disturbing to everybody. It felt like pulling the rug out under one's feet, and the institute struggled to deal with it. And I was thinking maybe there's a relationship between discrediting the Oedipus complex and these boundary violations, because think of it, when our patients start analysis, they develop a transference. And because of this transference, there come up parent-child feelings in the analysis. Now, Freud wrote this important paper, Observations on Transference Love, where he reminds all of us that the transference love is nothing to be proud of. It has nothing to do with our qualities. It is what the child transfers to the analyst, the early feelings to him, his or her own parents. And sexual boundary violations are always incestuous because of this transference relationship. And it may remind us of Ferenczi's paper on the confusion of tongue. I think it is a confusion of transference and real life that happens when these kinds of feelings are enacted. And I thought the third of Sophocles' plays, which is Antigone, it deals with a moral a conflict. Antigone deals with the conflict of obeying the law of her uncle, who is the governor at this point, who is the ruler of the country, or if she is supposed to hold on to and be faithful to her family members. It's the question of leaving the brother unburied in front of Thebes, which is what the uncle had ordered, or burying him, which would be faithful to her family member or to the laws of God, as Sophocles says, but break the law of the worldly ruler. So there are these conflicts to who one feels loyal, how to resolve these moral conflicts when they occur. And so I thought that's a good place to work through some of what may occur when such boundary violations take place as a result of unresolved Oedipal conflicts and difficulties, I think.
Yeah. Well, you give some really I'm trying to find the word, sort of vivid and intriguing stories around those issues, especially as the novel comes closer to an end. And it strikes me as what you were talking about. Among the, you know, the psychotherapies, psychoanalysis is the one that sort of honors transference, welcomes it, maybe even seeks to foster it. And what a sort of it is playing with fire a little bit, I guess we could say. And I'm trying to remember, wasn't there a movie that came out a few years ago about Carl Jung and Spielrein, and it had the name Dangerous? I can't remember the title of that film.
Yeah, but I don't remember it either, but I saw it exactly. That's a presentation of the dangers of transference love when they are basically exploited or abused by the analyst.
Yeah.
So not the occurrence of transference love is a problem. That's the patient's right. But to abuse it, to make use of it, of this weakness and transference, that's, I think, a grave mistake.
Uh-huh. The cover of the book, Memory's Eyes, maybe you want to say something about that title, Memory's Eyes, but also what would you say about the cover picture?
Well, the cover picture, I thought, could present the development. The first picture shows a father and a daughter who are charmed by each other, a little bit like in love with each other, despite being already adults. And tellingly, there's a middle chair between the two that is empty. So that would be the chair where the mother would be supposed to sit, but is not there. The second photo shows the same father and daughter, but they look a little sheepishly. They have now discovered something in their history that makes this, let's say, gushing love not possible anymore. So they have understood something about guilt, responsibility, weakness. I mean, children also have to learn about the weakness of their parents. The first idealized parent is slowly emerging also with all the not so good sides that he or she has. And taking all of this into account is a little bit of a shadow that is cast, but can also be worked through, I think, in most parent-child relationships, when we end up thinking, well, they were not the greatest, and this I missed, and that was not so right. But all in all, it was good enough, or it was they did what they could. So also a reconciliation with the weaknesses of the parents may occur. The novel ends probably a little bit before that by first being confronted with a knowledge that hadn't been there at the beginning, and that needs to be digested first, let's say, in the years after the novel ends.
Uh-huh. Can you talk about yourself as a psychoanalyst and a writer? There are, of course, psychoanalysts who write novels. Probably most of them don't, but you've written another novel before this one, and you've written other things too. Can you speak about that?
Yeah, I always loved to write. And actually, one of my early goals was to become a writer, but somehow I didn't manage. I wasn't successful, and I thought, I'm not gifted. I can't do this. And I was very happy to write psychoanalytic papers, and I dived into psychoanalytic theory, for which I also have a soft spot. I am fascinated with Freud's theory of the mind. And so for many years, I even dropped reading fiction because I was so involved in theory. But when I had worked all of this through, I came back to reading novels, and I thought, well, I could try just like that. And I tried, and I so enjoyed it and was so fascinated with this process of writing fiction. When I was sitting down, let's say one morning, not really knowing what I was going to write, and then after 4 or 5 hours, there was a piece there, a tale, a story was there that I had no idea before. And that was all of a sudden in my life. That was a very exciting experience. And so now, while I still continue to write once in a while a scientific paper, as we call it in psychoanalysis, I also enjoy novel writing. I'm currently writing on my third novel, and I still don't quite know how it will end. But I'm sure if I let it develop itself, it will show me how it needs to end.
And I think you should say something about your scientific writing, because you've got some recognition there too.
Well, what I was most interested in was Freud's drive theory, and in particular, his second drive theory, which introduces a life drive and a death drive, making aggression a representative of the death drive, so that psychoanalysis ended up with sexuality and aggression as the two main driving forces in mental life. And that somehow never really convinced me, the connection of a death drive with aggression. And so I started out, first I wanted to write only something about the death drive, and then I realized, no, it doesn't work, I have to write about the whole drive theory. And when I wanted to do a bigger essay on drive theory, I realized I need to include structure theory because we cannot think about the drives without thinking about the structures. And I ended up with working through Freud's whole metapsychology from the early beginning of the project, 1895, till the very end. And in this course, I developed a new understanding of the death drive, which included, in my view, what he had early on called the self-preservative drive and then dropped it. Not that he renounced it, but it was basically canceled. And I developed an understanding how the preservative drive, as I would call it, is important and powerful primary force in our life to preserve not only oneself, but also one's objects, and that this is the antagonist to sexuality. So my conclusion was that sexuality and the preservation of self and object, these are the two primal drives. That's why my recent book is also called Driven to Survive, because I wanted to emphasize and elaborate on this side of drive theory, because it hasn't so much been spoken about. And in this context, I was, of course, asked to develop an understanding of aggression. And I think my conclusion is aggression is an enhancement of both of these primal drives, that we, whenever our survival is at stake, or the survival of our objects, or our love objects are at stake, or our narcissism in terms of self-love, we become aggressive. We enhance their power. We assert ourselves because we want to be successful and satisfy these two primal drives. Does that make sense in a nutshell?
Well, what I'm most impressed with is you've managed to make sense of Freud's drive theory for yourself. You have, it seems to me, a very clear picture of how it can all work out in a way that's very helpful clinically too. So I'm going to read that book because I get lost in the way his theories change through the years and different names of the drives. And
yeah, it's actually an adventure to go through this. I always found it fascinating. So it took me many years. I worked probably altogether 20 years before I understood and resolved it, in my view, altogether. But I don't think it is a boring thing, and I hope you will find that too.
Oh, good. Well, in our last few minutes, have you read any other good psychoanalytic, either novels or scientific papers or books recently?
That's a great question. What I would love to recommend to you and to your listeners here, or to our listeners, are the books of Marine Dié. Marine Dié is a French Senegal writer who some years ago won the Prix Goncourt for her book Three Strong Women. It was translated into many languages and it's available in English. And what I find so fascinating with her, with all her books, I have read them all. I'm already waiting for the next one that will be published. What I find so fascinating is that she kind of slips into the mind of a slightly psychotic person and shows how the view of the world and reality and the objects slightly gets distorted. And we experience this as readers, as we go along in what happens, and become insecure of, well, is this real or is it not real? And it is a fascinating way of showing us what the mind of a person can do. So this is, I think, the writer with the highest sense of human psychology. And she does this with also a very unique and original style. So I think that would be the one author that I would very much recommend to psychoanalytic colleagues. In fact, I did recommend it, for the culture committee of the IPA. I founded a number of international psychoanalytic discussion groups on cultural issues, be it film or art or books or the like. And for those groups who wanted to discuss literature, analysts discussing literature with international colleagues via Zoom or via email, I recommended as a kickoff this novel, Three Strong Women, because I thought it is so suitable for psychoanalysts who love literature that they would find both something about her style and certainly a lot about the psychology of the protagonists in it.
Yeah, it actually sounds really relevant in this period of American history, culture, when we're so polarized as a nation, there's different realities people are seeing, and they're so invested in them, fanatically so. And it's such a sort of a mystery to try to understand how to account for that, the way people are seeing different worlds. And so Maureen, what's her last name again?
N-D-A, I don't know if I pronounce it correctly. It is spelled N-D-I-A-Y-E. And okay. The first two letters, N-D, are both capital letters, and the rest is E-A. So Marie N-D-A, you probably easiest find it with the title Three Strong Women. Get the author for free.
Well, I think we're out of time, but thank you so much for talking to us, for writing the book, for teaching us about Oedipal theory.
And thank you, Philip, for having me and for your observations. It was a great pleasure for me to talk a bit about it, and I thank you for it.
You're very welcome. You've been listening to an interview with Cordelia Schmidt-Hellerau. Okay, that's one of my very special patients calling me. I'm not surprised at all. Okay. She's very insistent. Let's see. You've been listening to an interview with Cordelia Schmidt-Hellerau. She's about her book, Memory's Eyes, a New York Oedipal novel. Here at the New Books in Psychoanalysis Network, please contact me at Philip J. Lance, Philip has one L, at gmail.com to let me know your thoughts and questions about the show. Thank you for listening.